has to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, brought to you by listeners like Kathleen Lowy, Patricia Player, Bill Lockemacher, and Jeffrey Adair. They voluntarily subscribe to the Peter B. Collins Show at peterbcollins.com.
As I was walking a ribbon of highway, I saw above me and in the skyway, I saw below me a golden valley. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.
On this program, we've been covering the issues related to the integrity of our election process since 2004. When my birth state of Ohio delivered results that propelled George W. Bush to a second term in office, and I strongly believe that that election was subjected to a heist in the Buckeye State, and we spent, when I had my daily syndicated radio show, every Friday we spent an hour talking about election issues, spearheaded by Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, who has been my personal expert on election integrity issues. The fight goes on, and despite the fact that the issues related to election problems have kind of receded in the month, the problems continue, and we saw this year for the first time complaints from Republicans that touchscreen voting machines were flipping their votes from a Republican selected to an unexpected Democrat. And despite that, it's a one-day story, and we don't really see a lot of attention paid to it. Lori Grace is a Bay Area activist and philanthropist, and the Grace Institute for Democracy and Election Integrity held its first award ceremony here in the Bay Area on the 16th of December. And one of those who was named as an award winner, actually two of those folks are here with me in the studio today, Tom Stanionis, who is the election supervisor in Yolo County, California, was selected, and he's unable to join us. But in the studio here are Carolyn Cernich from Humboldt County, California, where she serves as recorder, clerk, and registrar. Is that the
right
title?
Yes.
Of voters?
Yes.
And you and I have had the opportunity to talk many times in the past, and it's delightful to meet you in person, Carolyn.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you.
And Mitch Trachtenberg is an activist from Humboldt County. He's a volunteer with the Humboldt County Election Transparency Project. Mitch, good to see you.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And Mitch, when did you get interested in elections and election processes? After all, it's Carolyn's job.
Well, I probably became aware that things were not as I'd like to see them back in the 2000 election.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually approached some people in the elections department in Humboldt County at that time, and they weren't showing a great deal of interest. And I don't think it occurred to me at the time that I could just speak to Carolyn. But then in 2008, I was speaking with her through a mutual friend, had set us up with an appointment on something completely different, and we got to talking about election integrity, and I realized that Carolyn was as much interested in election integrity as any of the people out there who were clamoring for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, we've been working together.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, I just want to commend you, because in addition to this award, which I think you certainly deserve, in my interactions with you, I found you very open, very candid, and you present as an elected official, but your mindset really seems to be that of an individual voter. And you want your vote to count and to be counted, And you seem to really focus on that from end to end, beginning to end of the process of elections in your county.
Well, bear in mind that before you can run for a registered voter in the jurisdiction that you want to run in. So, yes, that is that's the root of it all, that I am a voter, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I have this other job that happens to oversee the elections as well.
Yeah. Now, this was not something that you sought or particularly trained for. You were the recorder and clerk, and then your county consolidated the functions under you, and I guess eliminated the position of registrar of voters.
Well, no, they added the title of registrar of voters to county clerk and recorder. But
so before
that
time, it wasn't elevated to an elective office?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I was first elected county recorder in 1990, there was also an elected county clerk registrar.
Mm-hmm.
About 96, I suppose, the courts, which were then under the county clerk, were split away. And so the office of county clerk was actually trifurcated, if you will,
mm-hmm.
into the courts, which went to the state of California, county clerk, which was attached to my title as county recorder, and then a separate office of an appointed registrar of voters mm-hmm. came into being. It was later that they realized that it would be better to have an elected registrar of voters rather than an appointed one.
Mm-hmm.
That way, our board of supervisors couldn't be seen as putting pressure on the registrar of voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so they attached that title and those duties then to county recorder and county clerk
mm-hmm.
and registrar of voters.
And Mitch, as she just described, elections are not even, 100% of her job description. But would you say she gives more than 100% to election issues?
There's no question about that. I mean, the Transparency Project came about when a commercial fisherman approached Carolyn, concerned about how we could actually be certain.
That's Kevin Collins, not my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And, no relation. And Kevin approached Carolyn, and we're all very lucky that we live in Humboldt, because mm-hmm. I think a more typical response might have been, "Get out of my office, get off my lawn."
How did you get into my office?
But Carolyn,
security.
But Carolyn immediately agreed. She recognized that there was an issue with people needing both to know that their vote was counting and to be able to participate in mm-hmm. the process of counting the votes.
Mm-hmm.
And so unlike what might have happened in some other jurisdictions, she was 100% and more behind the Transparency Project, in addition to all the other work she's doing in the county. Yes.
Yeah. And Carolyn, why is it? Have you had problems in Humboldt that you felt led people to dispute or to have less credibility or confidence in the outcome? Or is this simply proactivity on your part where you want to get it right and get it right every time?
It was more the proactive attitude
mm-hmm.
toward it because we had a system that was federally certified in California. And quite frankly, I did not at that point have any reason to question it other than quite a number of interested parties in Humboldt County who had heard things from other areas of the country, other areas of the state perhaps, and they voiced concern to me. Kevin was the first one that came to me and said, we've really got a problem here. Let's try to find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where our Transparency Project was born, basically.
Now, I want to hear more about this, but I have one more question for you, Carolyn, and that is, because I had a call-in radio show in Eureka for many years, I have a sense of the activist population there.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are real in-your-face, outraged and vocal and very amped up. And I'm just curious how you've dealt with the wide range of people in Humboldt County who have raised election integrity issues with you.
Well, wide range is an absolutely true statement, because there are those that frankly, were offensive in their confrontations over problems that weren't there, you mm-hmm. know, the boogeyman under the bed sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than just say, how did you get in here? isn't it better to try to gain their trust or reassure them by finding some proactive solution mm-hmm. rather than just sloughing off the problem?
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I thought that when we started this project, it would probably be a matter of me in the end being able to say, well, I told you so. Everything's fine. And for a while, it worked out that way, mm-hmm. for a while.
So what was the first signal to you that your systems needed improvement and that you were not able to conduct transparent elections, particularly with the Diebold tabulation system that you inherited?
Mm-hmm. It was, frankly, that it was a proprietary system that I personally couldn't understand. It took a lot of training and experience to understand how to program that system, how to test it, all of those things, how to design a ballot. And as I would pick up with each election more and more knowledge and experience in those areas, it was like I realized there's that much more that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then but fortunately, I had great staff, and I still do, who did understand that stuff, who were familiar with it and worked with it very well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, staff changes and so on. And in 2008, we learned a lesson thanks to the Transparency Project when, after we had counted all the vote-by-mail ballots, election night, report and everything seemed to be there. Added in all the precinct votes to that, and everything's looking good. And came back a week or so later to add in those vote by mail ballots that had been delivered to the polling places. How could it be that that original total went down by 197 votes
mm-hmm.
or ballots? And Mitch was able to pinpoint where those ballots were almost immediately, and that was the deck zero problem mm-hmm. that my predecessor had been aware of, but in the million things that he needed to tell me and train me on mm-hmm. Before he left the county, that was one that slipped through the cracks.
And I remember covering that at the time, but give our listeners a quick thumbnail of this deck zero. It's the way the systems are counted, and you're supposed to put kind of a dummy load at the front of the stack. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And delete that first batch.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would call it a dummy load. I mean, it's just that Diebold had a bug in their system.
Mm-hmm.
And the bug was such that when you do a very typical thing, which is taking a batch of ballots that you are scanning in, and maybe you have a double feed or there's some problem with it, the way in which that's typically handled in an elections office is to delete that entire batch
mm-hmm.
and to proceed to rescan it.
Mm-hmm.
Diebold's bug was that when you did that for the first time, let's say you've had 22 successful decks and the 23rd has a problem, so you delete it.
Right.
It also deletes the very first deck you scanned, which happened to be numbered zero in their
unless
counting
you
system.
Did that as a dummy batch, as
mm-hmm.
you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Diebold had sent out a notice that said, "Hey, here's something you ought to do. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you start up, you load that first batch and then you delete it." And they didn't really provide a very good explanation of why. They did not notify the California Secretary of State that this was a bug in their system, and they sent out one email that apparently went to somebody who since left the office without passing it along.
I see. And Carolyn, just as a standard, is there such a thing as a perfect election, or is every election tally subject to some margin of error?
Well, there are a bunch of humans involved in this process, and I think all of those humans are focused on and understand what the perfect election should look like in terms of process. However, It is entirely possible that at many different steps along the way, and we test and we proof and we check, but it is possible that...
The reason I ask is that my sense of Diebold, and it's now called Premier, and it's a narrowing group of competitors in the voting machine business, that they have a cavalier attitude. And that they say, well, you know, there's always going to be a little bit of margin of error, a few mistakes, and, you know, who cares? And this is the same company that makes the automatic teller machines that has never made an error with me in dispensing $20 bills. I've never gotten an extra one, and I've never been shorted. So when it comes to counting money, Diebold can get it, in my experience, 100% right. But when it comes to tabulating voting, it seems that they're just not as interested in getting to perfection. Mitch?
Well, I can't directly disagree with what you've said. I will, you know, in their defense, which I sort of hate to do, in their defense, it's actually, I think, a misnomer. When people talk about voting machines as being just like banking terminals, they're ignoring a number of differences. With a banking terminal, you know, you get to know how much you deposited. And if the bank doesn't give you a receipt, you get alarmed. And if you look at your account and see that your deposit or withdrawal, well, deposit, didn't get registered,
right,
you're going to get back to them very quickly. So there's no anonymity. There's no secrecy. There's nothing hidden.
Right.
With elections, to keep things secret, it's actually a harder problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I became involved in this primarily as a way to oppose ATM-style voting because there was no paper trail. And mm-hmm. I felt that without a paper trail, there was no way that things could be audited.
Right.
So Diebold does face a harder problem in ensuring that there's complete accuracy
and auditability in protecting the privacy of an individual
ballot. They seem pretty cavalier about the auditability. That's something I can say with 100% certainty.
Right. And when you talk about adding a paper trail to a touchscreen voting machine, I've seen these gizmos and actually, you know, pulled back the cover. And they're really a couple of different areas. There's a RAM, a kind of cache, that stores the information short term. There's a hard drive, and there also is the potential for an internet connection to send that vote. Now, many states aren't using that, including California, but those each are an opportunity for manipulation.
Yeah, let me...
And the paper trail could reflect what's on the screen without accurately reporting what went to the hard drive. Am I correct?
That's absolutely correct. Let me though divert for just 1 second since you mentioned internet voting. And this is the latest sort of horror story that's happening. And it's a personal concern that a lot of people who are not paying close attention to the issue see the convenience of something like internet voting and know that you can now buy your clothing and books on the internet and think, well, you know, people who know computers will be comfortable with internet voting, and it's just Luddites or people who are uncomfortable with them who are not. And the reality is actually exactly the opposite. People who are at extremely high levels in the computer science field, people who have developed security systems, people who have developed cryptographic coding, who are most horrified by the idea of internet voting, because they all recognize that there is simply no way, given the existing internet, to properly protect the system. And in fact, there was just a demonstration of that by a Professor Halderman mm-hmm. of the University of Michigan a few weeks ago, where his team, given an opportunity to break into a DC experiment,
mm-hmm.
immediately found that they could get complete access.
Yeah, and they tooted their horn by setting it up so that every time somebody submitted a vote, the Michigan fight song played.
And DC never noticed.
and we covered that. The other thing that was very interesting is that evidence surfaced that computers from China and Iran had tried to penetrate. And they may have been bots, they may have been web crawlers, but we don't know. And it just raises grave concerns about internet voting, so thanks for raising that. Now, let's take a couple of minutes to describe the Transparency Project in Humboldt County. And Carolyn, why don't you start off and describe why you decided to engage in this process?
Well, we mentioned Kevin Collins a bit ago. he and another commercial fisherman, Dave Bitts, came into my office and expressed their concern over election integrity in general, specifically in Humboldt County, where they are both registered voters. And I appreciated their stand, but gosh, what do I do about it? And asked that of them. Kevin came back several times after that. We talked about what can I do about that, or what can be done about that. He suggested that would it be possible for someone to stand with a video camera and watch each ballot as it's automatically fed into the counting devices,
the optical scan.
Uh-huh. Yes, AccuVotes. The problem with that is that that would be okay for only one side of a ballot that usually has voting opportunities on both sides,
mm-hmm.
and they'd only have the opportunity to see one side of it. And we have optical scan devices in each of the polling places in Humboldt County, so that would mean having someone there from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. With their video camera. And further, the privacy of the voter would be violated if that was done at the polling place. So that wouldn't work. But it kind of planted the seed of, well, yes, a picture of the ballots would be good. And that really into what we need is a high-speed scanner and a number of volunteers. And after the election is over and the results are published, we will make them available to the public. At the time, we thought we'll make them available to the public online, and we did that for a couple of elections. But bandwidth is an issue in Humboldt County, and so now if voters want to examine those ballots, the images of those ballots that have been scanned, they can contact me for a set of DVDs.
Mm-hmm. And Mitch, what was the practical aspect of implementing this?
Well, we wanted to do it with software where anyone would be able to inspect any line of what we were using, and that means open source software. And Kevin was able to investigate scanners and found a high-speed scanner that met all the requirements for the project and that also had a set of open source drivers that had been developed by someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set up software simply to control that scanner using these drivers. We took advantage of the Linux operating system, which is completely open source, and we took advantage of something called GPG, GNU Privacy Guard, which is a program that allows you to take a file, or a file that's actually a collection of images, and digitally sign it so that you can prove that what somebody sees at the other end of an internet connection is what you signed at your end of the internet connection. If there's any tampering, that's detectable. And the idea of the Transparency Project was simply to make these images available in a form that people could recognize was what the elections office was providing. I felt that although the Transparency Project was saying that's how far we have to go and then people can count them if they want, I felt it would be really useful to provide at least one independent count. And so I developed software, not particularly sophisticated software. It's the sort of thing that a computer science class could treat maybe as a class term project that is going to go in and just determine for each vote opportunity how light or dark it is. And you find that gives you a very good division into voted and non-voted areas.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not sure, when it's something in an intermediate intensity, you can flag that out for manual hand counting. And so the idea is, once you have the images from the scanner, if you can prove to your satisfaction that those images reflect the paper documents that you have, then you can go ahead and add those up using this software or using whatever software you might want or using a bunch of people in a room watching the images go by and hand counting.
Now, Carolyn, in your presentation before the awards last night, you made reference to the November 2010 election where this system came into play and was valuable for one or more candidates. It was a healthcare district?
Yes. We had a small district in Humboldt County that had a very close election. There were
You said there's positions available, there
were three
and there
positions
were four
available.
Candidates?
Well, I think there were actually eight candidates.
Okay.
And the candidate with the fourth candidate was only 14 votes behind the third place candidate. It's a small district, but still, 14 votes, gosh, that's the people that live in your block.
You yeah, know? Yeah.
That's a very small number. It would have been expensive for that candidate to call for a recount of all of the ballots in that district, especially considering that it reaches a few voters in Mendocino County as well.
Mm-hmm.
I suggested that, and when I say expensive, when you're talking about a race of maybe a couple thousand voters at the most, it would probably be a few thousand dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggested that she might look at the ballots on DVDs, mm-hmm. the images of the ballots, and contact Mitch. His system is available online. And count them herself.
Mm-hmm.
It was my hope that she would follow through and actually go through that process. Instead, she called Mitch and said, "What do you think?" And so he took a look at them for her.
Mm-hmm.
For her. Another much bigger race, one of the supervisor districts in Humboldt County, had a very close race between two good candidates. And it was definitely a consideration of the candidate who narrowly lost, that it may be worthwhile, and he too to call for a recount, and he too contacted Mitch and said, "No, it's I think we're good."
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, it's really common sense. You know, there at the dawn of computer use in elections, it was being stated that you would use redundant systems under the control of different elected officials, and somehow that never happened, for whatever reason. But redundancy is a completely understood idea. When you fly in an airplane, you want to make sure that the instruments are redundant, not because you're concerned that there's fraud in one of the altimeters, but because you're concerned it might break. You're
yeah.
concerned it might be wrong. You're
right.
concerned it wasn't perfect, as you'd been alluding to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have a second independent system doing this sort of count is something that provides a lot of reassurance, as
yeah.
well it should.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, I have two more questions for you. One is, it's important to note that you're not the empress of elections, that you have to live within state rules, laws, and
yes.
guidelines. The equipment that's certified by the Secretary of State, sometimes by the Federal Elections Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to navigate in between these legal barriers and other standards. And I'm just curious, have you learned a lot about computers? Do you wish you'd gone to law school? Or maybe you did. I don't know.
I did not. No.
How has this changed you, and how have you managed to, you know, explore all this and stay inside the boundaries?
Well, I think we're lucky in California to have Deborah Bowen as our Secretary of State, because transparency and integrity in elections is a serious concern of hers. And while that is sort of offended or riled some of my counterparts throughout California, I find it to be very reassuring
mm-hmm.
That she is supportive of a project such as ours. I should make sure that it's clear to your listeners that the Humboldt Election Transparency Project is an audit process and a secondary counting of the ballots.
Mm-hmm.
We do use a system that is certified by federally and by the Secretary of State as our primary counting device, and
mm-hmm.
our transparency project is a secondary check on that first certified system.
Mm-hmm. Question is this whole openness and transparency thing scary for a public official? Because, you know, you often get caught between competing interests,
mm-hmm.
and if you are too open, can that end up exposing things that you'd rather not see out there in the
well,
light
I can
of day?
Tell you, I can tell you that after the in early December of 2008, I found it very embarrassing to call the Secretary of State and say, I made a mistake, and I certified the wrong, the numbers that I certified were incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I found them, I reported them, I corrected them. But I think there are some people that, rather than looking at the programs or audits such as the Transparency Project, looking at that from the angle of I, the election official, am going to be able to say most of the time, see, I told you it was right.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, I have no desire to say I made a mistake.
Right.
Comes
once
with
you
the
make
territory,
a mistake,
though.
Once you make a mistake and admit it, even though I consider that the honorable thing to do and the you know, absolutely the right thing to do, there are people who say, well, she admitted she made a mistake. The system is corrupt.
Yes, that's right.
And so you do, I'm sure you do have concerns that this honesty thing can backfire in the hands of the wrong people. And you've got a really aggressive right-wing newspaper.
Not anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did it go under?
Yeah.
No kidding. The Searchlight, right?
No, that's no.
Oh, no, that's in Reading.
There was a paper called the Eureka Reporter.
The Reporter, right.
Our only newspaper now is the Times Standard.
Uh-huh. Well, it's great to see you both. And, Carolyn, a real pleasure to meet you. And I really appreciate that you've been singled out for this award. And I hope
you will
continue to maintain these high standards and involve the public in ways that build confidence in our elections.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Carolyn Cernich and Mitch Trachtenberg from Humboldt County, California. And the Peter B. Collins Show continues. We're sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Remember VHS? Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. And for free shipping on any order, enter the magic letters PBC in the comments section of the website order form. We continue our conversations about election integrity. And we're joined by two other individuals who attended the Grace Institute for Democracy and Election Integrity Awards, held on December 16 here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Eric Lazarus joins us now. He is the author of a book called The Machinery of Democracy, Protecting Elections in Electronic World. He's a consultant for Stanford University and the Accurate Project, principal investigator of the study Public for Justice, that's at New York University that we just referred to. And welcome to our program, Eric.
Good to meet you, Peter.
Good to see you. And Pam Smith is here, too, from verifiedvoting.org. Hello, Pam.
Hi, nice to see you.
Now, just by way of introduction, Pam, how long have you been interested in this whole election integrity business?
I got involved in, well, I'm from Chicago originally, so, you know, I've been interested in elections for a very long time. But I got involved in this issue in late 2003, early 2004. In San Diego County, where we were in late 2003 on the verge of buying 10,200 new paperless touchscreen voting machines. That was about the point of entry for me.
Mm-hmm. And was there a disputed election there, like the Bill Bray Busby campaign that got you activated?
It was actually earlier than that. I think the idea of jumping into an entirely new voting system with that many pieces of complex equipment in a jurisdiction that hadn't used that kind of complex technology before, and no fail-safe, no paper ballots in the polling place in mm-hmm. case something goes terribly wrong, and something went terribly wrong in the first election. So
yeah.
That was March of 2004.
And Eric, what was your trajectory into this field of endeavor?
I was asked by the Brennan Center for Justice to develop a study in the run-up to the 2004 election. Trying to answer the question, given that there are so many paperless touchscreen voting machines that, you know, are essentially unauditable, where there's nothing to check the electronic records against, you know, what's the best that election officials can do with these basically pretty bad sorts of election technology?
Making chicken salad out of chicken poop?
Right. What what can you do? And so that was the first study that I did with the Brennan Center for Justice, and mm-hmm. that was followed by the study that you mentioned where we were asked to investigate the question, can you say in an authoritative way what levels of security can be attained by various technologies? Can mm-hmm. you actually quantify the level of security?
Mm-hmm.
The then director of the Democracy Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, Dr. Deborah Goldberg, said, look, we're hearing from election officials that most fraud has been committed on paper,
mm-hmm.
and we're hearing from the technologists that purely electronic machines are fundamentally untrustworthy. Can you say with any authority what is actually trustworthy and what is not?
Mm-hmm.
And we developed a methodology along with some of the most sophisticated security researchers in the world that involves calculating the number of people that it would take to defraud various classes of elections. So this measure of attack team size is the core of my research in elections.
Now, attack team, it's one guy with a minibar key from Holiday Inn, right?
There are combinations of technologies and procedures where a single individual or a very, very small team can impact the outcome of an election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we consider the failing grade. Now, what the passing grade is it 10? Is it 100? Is it 1,000? I think that's a decision that policymakers should make. I think they would try to get it up there so that it's only possible to steal the election if, you know, virtually everybody is involved.
And Eric, when you looked at this, were these hypothetical threats or were they based on analysis of prior elections where you'd seen at least symptoms, if not actual indications, of efforts to tamper?
Great question. We did both. When we were aware of a prosecution of an individual or even an allegation of an attack, we factor that kind of attack in,
mm-hmm.
as well as just putting smart people in a room and saying, okay, so the election is done this way. On a practical level, how would you attack that election?
Mm-hmm.
And even asking the election officials themselves, imagine, you know, that your successor is a totally dishonest person. What,
right.
What might they do given the procedures you have in place? So it's a combination of brainstorming and book research.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about two of the things that occur to me as the most obvious potentials for manipulation. One is that as we were alluding to with Mitch and Carolyn, that in the touchscreen voting machines, there are actually three, possibly four opportunities for manipulation of the intention of the voter. So in that context, what were the primary threats that you addressed, and what can we do to defend against them, besides just scrapping the machines and going to paper ballots?
Oh, what can be done to use totally paperless touchscreen voting machines in a safe and trustworthy way?
Yeah.
Nothing.
That's what I thought.
I mean, fundamentally, there's no way to make them really trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
There's things you can do to make an attacker's life a little more troublesome. So, for example, if the machines are completely isolated so that the person attacking them has, you know, is more likely to have to be an insider.
Mm-hmm.
So you can reduce the number of people who have access to corrupting. The ultimate example of going the opposite direction is what the Department of Defense is planning to do, where I attended a conference recently called the UACAVA, the Uniform and Oversee Voters
mm-hmm.
Conference, where even though the officials from the Defense Department were in a room of some of the smartest security technologists in the world, who are telling them there is no way to make internet voting secure.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, the guidelines for internet voting are like guidelines for drunk driving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't do it, right? Very, very simple guideline. They were still saying, yeah, we're committed to doing it. Tell us what it was unacceptably bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, purely touchscreen voting, there's just too many opportunities for malware, for misconfiguration, to steal or add votes.
It's we also have issues of chain of custody. We see stories, countless stories, of voting machines that were dropped off at a precinct a week or two before the election and just sitting there in an open room or, you know, maybe some people have access to it. Pam, the other big vulnerability from my point of view is the link between the precinct's optical scanner and the central count at the registrar's office. And that's something that could be hacked into. Also, people who are clever enough could essentially dummy up and act like a precinct and report in and displace the actual report from a precinct. That's my active imagination working. Do you see that as a real source of vulnerability in the system?
Well, it can be. I think that there are different ways to air gap that and make it more effective and more secure. That's the kind of thing that gets examined in things like top-to-bottom reviews of voting systems and Everest reports and that sort of thing, and a lot of the good work that's being done by the Accurate folks. You know, in the end, all of the voting systems, no matter what kind of voting system it is, have to have two basic properties to really be worthwhile. And the first property is a voter has to be able to check that their vote was recorded the way that they intended it.
Mm-hmm.
On some kind of independent record, some kind of independent of the software that it's using to count record. And election officials have to be able to use those records to prove that the votes are being counted correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be true no matter who makes the system, no matter how well or poorly made it is, no matter how much it's been certified or tested and certified by whichever bodies. And testing and certification in the end doesn't take the place of having those properties. You can't certify your way into that level of verifiability. You have to have those properties, those features, and you have to be doing those robust, legitimate manual checks on the system to be able to demonstrate that it's working the way it should. Now, certification and testing and well-made systems can solve for voters being disenfranchised because things are just breaking down or, you know, failing in the polling place and that sort of thing. And that's important. And to that end, I think that there are ways that we can have better voting systems and we can, you know, certification is so broken right now. It takes so long to get anything through. It costs so much. It's the wrong model in many ways. And some jurisdictions, some states rely on it for security. And it's just completely insufficient for that.
Well, and in our conversations off mic here, what I've picked up is that the unintended consequence of this expensive and laborious certification process is that when bugs are discovered, the companies don't want to fix them. They'd rather just cover it up and pretend it's not there than go through the consuming process to say, oh, we want to fix that.
I think they probably do want to fix them, but what happens is that they have to collect them all together, or they, you know, this is how they do it. Let's say you just got a system through certification. The very next day, you're going to find a problem. So you hold that and you collect them together until, you know, a year down the road or 2 years down the road when you've got a new version, and then you put them all through together. And then it takes another year or so to get through the process. And by then, you've probably got another version.
Yeah.
So it is very cumbersome. I wouldn't want to go through that for each and every bug. There has to be a way that people know more readily, sooner, when there is a problem. And a clearinghouse model for some of that kind of information, I think, could be a useful interim measure. And it should be there anyway. We use something like that for automobiles when something goes wrong and there's a recall. Everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
Something goes wrong in a voting system. One jurisdiction knows about it, where it went wrong. How does the rest of the country find out that's using the same system, for example?
Yeah. And Eric Lazarus, you have some ideas about this to, number one, try to get away from these private corporate vendors who own the codes and declare proprietary the processes that are occurring in this very public process of our elections. Talk about that. Take a minute or two.
Yeah, I would argue that almost as broken as the certification process itself is the very concept of using private companies to build election technology. Now, I'm not saying that every team of people building open source, freely redistributable technology would automatically build a good system. I am saying that it is possible for example, a consortium of counties, high net worth individual, whatever, to fund for a small number of single digit million dollars. Wonderful technology that could be used across many counties in a very cost-effective way. this would have many advantages. So, for example, right now we've got a situation where the vendors often end up with way too much power in the situation that they have. So, for example, after noted election administrator Ion Sancho allowed Hari Hursti and Hugh Thompson an opportunity, as documented in the Machinery of Democracy HBO documentary, the opportunity to investigate how they would defraud an election using his technology. His vendor withdrew support for him, and then in sequence, every other vendor that was certified in Florida refused to sell Leon County his county technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what would react if we found out that Airbus or Boeing, once United Airlines, reported a problem to the FAA that suddenly they couldn't buy airplanes anymore?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, that would be a national scandal. Now, why isn't it a national scandal when we get these kind of high-handed, completely irresponsible behavior from some, in that case, every Florida vendor? He had to literally sue them to be able to buy technology. Mm-hmm. This is just wrong. There isn't that much technology needed to run an election. If it were done by a nonprofit organization, academics and other researchers could vet the requirements document, the design document, the design, the actual code. They could vet the testing regime. You know, every step along the way could be vetted. Right now, we have the opposite. When the Ohio folks did the Everest study, guess what? All the technology is terrible. When before that, the California group called the so-called top-to-bottom review did the study, guess what? It's all terrible. Before that, in Maryland, guess what? It's all terrible.
Mm-hmm.
How many times do we have to find out that the commercial vendors produce terrible technology to stop doing this and just to realize that we don't just spend a few million dollars and build the technology and then make it available? And that way, election officials, instead of being in this terrible power position where they have to keep their vendor happy, or maybe I won't get good support when I call in and I need some help, they would be able to hire anyone, IBM Global Services, a nonprofit organization, an independent consultant, to help them when they needed election administration technology support.
Pam, what do you think of this idea?
Well, I think it certainly is a direction that we have to think about going. Look, privacy in elections in terms of a secret ballot, that's a good thing. Privacy in elections in terms of private software or private systems is not desirable. You know, it means fewer sets of eyes looking at the system. It doesn't contribute to the quality of the system. And I think we as voters and we as a nation deserve better than that.
Now, Eric, one of the things that comes to mind is, and maybe this is too utopian, but should there be a single national standard? And I agree with you about open source and public ownership. It should not be privately held or controlled. But one of the things that surfaced in Florida in 2000 is that every county had a different system. And one of the things that the courts wrestled with when ultimately the Republican-controlled Supreme Court determined that election was whether any kind of a recount or audit could properly be conducted because of the patchwork of systems and practices across that state. So what's your thought about that? Is it possible to come up with a system that should be deployed everywhere, or is it better to have a more competitive approach where we're always, you know, yearning to get better or to reach some level of perfection?
It's a wonderful question. I guess what makes sense to me is to use the model that already works. I can use Red Hat Linux, right? Or I can use Ubuntu Linux. I can take one distribution or another distribution, and each one of these nonprofit open source freely available technologies competes with one another. So yes, I would love to be part of one nonprofit that's producing a technology, and I'd like to vie with another one or two or three to try to be the national voting machine. But I don't want it to be a foregone conclusion. I want to have to beat them. Mm-hmm. I want to be the best. And I want, either is it at the state level or the county level,
to have the shootout. And so, right, so I think I would favor more than one open source solution, vying to argue that we're the best and having to try to always be pushing forward to be the best. So, yeah, I think I would be interested in a more competitive approach. But, hey, even one that election officials are beginning to use and to see it's cheaper, it's better, it's easy to manage,
mm-hmm.
Even one would be a lot better than zero. Three might be an ideal number.
Pam?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I always tell people, be careful what you wish for. You know, mm-hmm. when people look for, should we have a uniform system statewide or even a uniform system nationally? Jurisdictions are so different. We have voting jurisdictions here in California. We have the largest voting jurisdiction in the country. That's Los Angeles County. And it's huge. And there are millions of voters. And then you have, you could fit many other states into Los Angeles County. Then you have counties that are, you know, 1,000 voters or fewer, for whom the election official is a part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different and I think have, in some ways, different needs. All of them have the same need for that kind of verifiability and auditability. And all of them have a need for quality systems. So I'm not sure that it has to be the same system nationwide, but I do think it has to have those same properties and those same qualities. And look, elections, like any other kind of process, look at it like continuous process improvement. Right now, anyone will tell you there's no perfect voting system, and that's true. But all voting systems can be improved. And I think that that's going to continue to be true.
Mm-hmm. Now, have each of you found that interest in these issues is flagging, and in particular that the people who are most at risk from bad elections, meaning elected officials, seem to be the least interested in the integrity of our elections? Because my sense is that while I'm still very concerned about this and I talk about it quite a bit, that public officials have taken the position that questioning the integrity of our elections is bad for their business.
You know, that could be true, but I think some of the staunchest advocates we've ever had are elected officials who have been involved in a close contest that couldn't be recounted.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be in that position again. And so... you know, I'm not sure that interest is flagging. I think, you know, we've had a tough time economically, and there are many other issues that people are looking at, and it may not be right at the forefront for mm-hmm. a lot of people. But I believe that more and more people are learning and understanding about the hazards of the kinds of voting systems, and in particular, this recent the recent hack of the Washington, D.C. internet voting experiment, I think, was very telling and put this issue on the radar again for a lot of people in a new context. You know, if you don't like paperless touchscreen voting machines, well, internet voting is like that on steroids. You know, mm-hmm. it's a massive problem that we're facing. And Eric mentioned about the UOCAVA, the Uniform Overseas Citizens Conference, where there was a lot of technical advice. I think that the problem we have is the rock and the hard place. There appears to be a mandate for some kind of internet voting program that officials feel they have to carry out. And until that mandate goes away, they will continue to feel like they have to carry that out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we've got the issue of, and you can't do it safely,
mm-hmm.
Not on this internet. Mm-hmm. So I think that that has helped raise a lot of people's awareness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just imagine if WikiLeaks tried to vote, you know. Eric, what's your thought about that?
I mean, I really just want to focus on this point around the importance of stopping internet voting in its tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And internet voting has, you know, essentially all the same problems that touchscreen voting machines have, except now the entire world, you know, the Chinese secret police hackers, the mafia in Russia, whatever, all of those people now have wonderful access to be able to hack our elections. I think it's very important for people to take an opportunity to call your legislator, write to your legislator and say, you know, the Department of Defense seems to think that there's a law there
mm-hmm.
that says they have to go forward and pilot absurd, you know, systems that security people are telling us, you know, make it clear to the Defense Department. Does that mean pass a law, or some kind of Or just write to them, let them know, no, if security cannot be assured, and it will not be assured. There's simply no way to do this, not now and not in any near-term future that any of us can imagine. It's very important for the military to know that even piloting these systems is just a waste of money. The way that that military people need to be supported, and it's very important that they be supported with better access to the ballot, has to do with calendar changes. That ballots need to be sent out earlier, and they need to be given, basically the windows for voting need to be opened up so that that our service members who risk their lives get good access to the ballot. But internet voting, particularly from uncontrolled PCs, which is what just think about it. If you can't keep viruses and malware and spyware from hitting your PC, how can we assure, for example, privacy to a soldier who might be voting from overseas? It's just a non-starter.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure with you on that. Pam, what other issues are you focused on at Verified Voting that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think the internet voting is key for us right now. We're also focusing a lot on how we can improve the way that we do auditing post-election checks on the vote counts. And there is a lot of excitement around that because with work like the Election Transparency Project in Humboldt County and other ways to improve how you can check the ballot count after the election is done, we can make this more efficient and more effective and more cost-effective. And cost is really one of the big issues that's stopping improvements in elections. Cost has been cited for why some states that have actually passed voter-verified paper ballot laws have not yet implemented those laws.
Mm-hmm.
And until we can solve for cost in a way that allows election officials who are working hard around the nation to have the kinds of resources they need to make their chain of custody better and their systems more secure and be able to do post-election audits and robust pre-election testing and get legitimate, decent systems, we're not going to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find a way to direct the resources appropriately.
And Eric, what else are you focused on that you'd like to mention?
Oh, well, I look forward to, I hope, an opportunity to come back and talk to you at another time in more detail. But I'm working on a process for auditing that will achieve as high or higher levels of security as is achieved currently in Humboldt, potentially without the need to actually publish ballots. So I want to explore the different ways that could be done. And I would love to, when we're a little further along, come back and have an opportunity to run it by you.
Well, please be in touch, and I'll look forward to that. Eric Lazarus, Pam Smith, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'd appreciate your comments. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.